The music faltered. The grass hissed beneath her hands, smoking. She groaned, fumbling inside for the three tethers to the fires. But she was a maze, a labyrinth, the strings all tangled and...
I'm sorry,
Rowan hissed, swearing again. And the air vanished. She tried to groan, to move. But she had no air. No air for that inner fire. Blackness swept in. Oblivion. Then she was gasping, arcing off the grass, the fires now crackling naturally, and Rowan hovering over her.
Breathe. Breathe.
Though he'd snapped her tethers to the fires, she was still burning. Not burning on the outside, where even the grass had stopped smoldering. She was burning up from within. Each breath sent fire down her lungs, her veins. She could not speak or move. She had shoved herself over some boundary, hadn't heard the warning signs to turn back, and she was burning alive beneath her skin. She shook with tearless, panicked sobs. It hurt. It was endless and eternal, and there was no dark part of her where she could flee to escape the flames. Death would be a mercy, a cold, black haven. She didn't know Rowan had left until he came sprinting back, two females in tow. One of them said, "Can you stand to carry her? There aren't any water wielders here, and we need to get her into cold water, now." She didn't hear what else was said. Heard nothing but the pounding, pounding of that forge under her skin. There was a grunt and a hiss, and then she was in Rowan's arms, bouncing against his chest as he hurtled through the woods. Every step sent splinters of red-hot pain through her. Though his arms were ice-cold, a frigid wind pressing on her, she was adrift in a sea of fire. Hell. This is what the Dark God's underworld felt like. This was what awaited her when she took her last breath. It was the horror of that thought that made her focus on what she could grasp, namely the pine and snow smell of Rowan. She pulled that smell into her lungs, pulled it down deep, and clung to it as though it were a lifeline tossed into a stormy sea. She didn't know how long it took, but her grasp on him was weakening, each pulse of fiery pain fraying it. But then it was darker than the woods, and the sounds echoed louder, and they took stairs, and then...
Get her into the water.
She was lowered into the water in the sunken stone tub. Then steam brushed her face. Someone swore.
Freeze it, Prince! The second voice commanded. Now!
There was a moment of blissful cold, but then the fire surged and...
Get her out!
Strong hands yanked at her, and she had the vague sense of hearing bubbling. She had boiled the water in that tub. Almost boiled herself. She was in another tub a moment later, the ice forming again, then melting. Melting and...
Breathe,
Rowan said by her ear, kneeling at the head of the tub.
Let it go. Let it get out of you.
Steam rose, but she took a breath.
Good,
Rowan panted. Ice formed again. Melted. She was sweating, heat pulsing against her skin like a drum. She did not want to die like this. She took another breath. Like the ebb and flow of the tide, the bath froze, then melted, slower each time. And each time, the cold soaked into her a bit more, numbing her, urging her body to relax. Ice and fire, frost and embers. Locked in a battle, pushing and pulling. Beneath it, she could almost taste Rowan's steel will slamming against her magic, a will that refused to let the fire burn her into nothing. Her body ached, but now the pain was mortal. Her cheeks were still aflame, but the water went cold.
then lukewarm, then warm and... stayed that way. Warm, not hot.
We need to get those clothes off her, one of the females said.
Selena lost track of time as two small sets of hands eased up her head and then stripped off her sodden clothes. Without them, she was almost weightless in the water. She didn't care if Rowan saw. Didn't think there was an inch of a woman's body he hadn't already explored anyway.
She lay there, eyes shut,
face tilted toward the ceiling. After a while, Rowan said,
"Just answer yes or no. That's all you have to do."
She managed a slight nod, though she winced as pain shot down her neck and shoulders.
"Are you in danger of flaring up again?"
She was breathing as evenly as she could, the heat pounding in her cheeks, her legs, her core. But it was steadily diminishing.
"No,"
she whispered, a brush of hot air from her tongue.
"Are you in pain?"
Not a sympathetic question, but a commander assessing his soldier's condition to sort out the best course of action.
"Yes."
A hiss of steam. A woman said,
"We will prepare a tonic. Just keep her cool."
Soft feet padded on the stone floors on their way out. Then came the snick of the door to the bath's closing. There was a slosh of water in a bucket. Then, Selena sighed, or tried to, as an ice-cold cloth was laid on her forehead. More sloshing, then another cloth dripped freezing water under her hair, her neck.
"The burnout,"
Rowan said quietly.
"You should have told me you were at your limit."
Speaking was too hard. But she opened her eyes to find him kneeling at the head of the bath, a bucket of water beside him, and a cloth in his hands. He wrung it again over her brow. The water so wonderful she would have moaned. The bath cooled further, but was still warm. Too warm.
"If you'd gone on any longer, the burnout would have destroyed you. You must learn to recognize the signs and how to pull back before it's too late."
Not a statement, but a command.
"It will rip you apart inside. Make this..."
He shook his head again.
"Make this look like nothing. You don't touch your magic until you've rested for a while. Understand?"
She tilted her head up, beckoning for more cold water on her face. But he refused to wring the cloth until she nodded her agreement. He cooled her off for another few moments, then slung the cloth over the side of the bucket and stood.
"I'm going to check on the tonic. I'll be back soon."
He left once she'd nodded again. If she hadn't known better, she might have thought he was fussing. Worried, even. She hadn't been old enough in Terrison to have anyone teach her about the deadly side to her power. And no one had explained, since her lessons had been so limited. She hadn't felt like she was burning out. It had come on so quickly. Maybe that was all there was to her magic. Maybe her well didn't go as deep as everyone had thought. It would be a relief if that were true. She lifted her legs, groaning at the aches along her muscles, and leaned forward far enough to hug her knees. Above the lip of the sunken tub, there were a few candles burning on the stones, and she glared at the flames, hated the flames, though she supposed they needed light in here. She rested her forehead on her scarred knees, her skin nearly scorching. She shut her eyes, piecing her splintered consciousness together. The door opened. Rowan. She kept herself in that cool darkness, savoring the growing chill in the water, the quieting pulse under her skin. He sounded about halfway across the room when his footsteps halted. His breath caught, harsh enough that she looked over her shoulder. But his eyes weren't on her face or the water. They were on her bare back. Curled as she was against her knees, he could see the whole expanse of ruined flesh, each scar from the lashings.
"Who did that to you?"
It would have been so easy to lie. But she was so tired, and he had saved her useless hide. So she said,
"A lot of people. I spent some time in the salt mines of Endovir."
He was so still that she wondered if he'd stopped breathing.
"How long?"
he asked after a moment. She braced herself for the pity, but his face was so carefully blank. No, not blank. Calm with lethal rage.
"A year. I was there a year before. It's a long story."
She was too exhausted, her throat too raw to say the rest of it. She noticed then that his arms were bandaged, and more bandages across his broad chest peeked up from beneath his shirt. She'd burned him again. And yet he had held on to her, had run all the way here and not let go once.
"You were a slave."
She gave him a slow nod. He opened his mouth, but shut it and swallowed, that lethal rage winking out. As if he remembered who he was talking to, and that it was the least punishment she deserved. He turned on his heel and shut the door behind him. She wished he'd slammed it, wished he'd shattered it. But he closed it with barely more than a click, and did not return. Chapter 42. Her back. Rowan soared over the trees, riding and shaping the winds to push him onward, faster, their roar negligible to the bellowing in his head. He took in the passing world out of instinct rather than interest. His eyes turned inward, toward that slab of ruined flesh glistening in the candlelight. The gods knew he'd seen plenty of harrowing injuries. He'd bestowed plenty of them on his enemies and friends alike. In the grand sense of things, her back wasn't even close to some of those wounds. Yet when he'd seen it, his heart had clean stopped. And for a moment there had been an overwhelming silence in his mind. He felt his magic and his warrior's instincts honing into a lethal combination the longer he stared, howling to rip apart the people who had done that with his bare hands. Then he just left, hardly making it out of the baths before he shifted and soared into the night. Maeve had lied, or lied by omission, but she knew. She knew what the girl had gone through, knew she'd been a slave. That day early on, he'd threatened to whip the girl gods above, and she had lost it. He'd been such a proud fool that he'd assumed she'd lashed out because she was nothing more than a child. He should have known better. Should have known that when she did react to something like that, it meant the scars went deep. And then there were the other things he'd said. He was almost to the towering line of the Cambrian Mountains. She had barely grown into her woman's body when they hurt her like that. Why hadn't she told him? Why hadn't Maeve told him? His hawk loosed a piercing cry that echoed on the dark gray stones of the mountain wall before him. A chorus of unearthly howls rose in response. Maeve's wild wolves, guarding the passes. Even if he flew all the way to Doranel, he'd reach his queen and demand answers and... She would not give them to him. With the blood oath, she could command he not go back to Mistward. He gripped the winds with his magic, choking off their current. Aelin had not trusted him. had not wanted him to know. And she'd almost burned out completely, gods be damned, leaving her currently defenseless. Primal anger sharpened in his gut, brimming with a territorial possessive need. Not a need for her, but a need to protect, a male's duty and honor. He had not handled the news as he should have. If she hadn't wanted to tell him about being a slave, then she probably had done so assuming the worst about him, just as she was probably assuming the worst about his leaving. The thought didn't sit well. So he veered back to the north and reined his magic to pull the winds with him, easing his flight back to the fortress. He would get answers from his queen soon enough. The healers gave her a tonic, and when Selena reassured them that she wasn't going to incinerate herself, she stayed in the bath until her teeth were chattering. It took 3 times as long as usual to get back to her rooms, and she was so frozen and drained that she didn't change into clothes before she dropped into bed. She didn't want to think about what it meant that Rowan had left like that. But she did, aching and cramping from the magic. She drifted into a jerking, fitful sleep, the cold so fierce she couldn't tell whether it was from the temperature or the aftermath of the magic. At some point, she was awoken by the laughing and singing of the returning revelers. After a while, even the drunkest found their bed, or someone else's. She was almost asleep again, teeth still chattering, when her window groaned open in the breeze. She was too cold and sore to get up. There was a flutter of wings and a flash of light, and before she could roll over, he'd scooped her up, blanket and all. If she'd had any energy, she might have objected. But he carried her up the 2 flights of stairs, down the hall, and then a roaring fire, warm sheets, and a soft mattress, and a heavy quilt that was tucked in with surprising gentleness. The fire dimmed on a phantom wind, and then the mattress shifted. In the flickering dark, he said roughly,
"You're staying with me from now on."
She found him lying as far away from her as he could get, without falling off the mattress.
"The bed is for tonight. Tomorrow you'll get a cot. You'll clean up after yourself, or you'll be back in that room."
She nestled into her pillow. "Very well." The fire dimmed, yet the room remained toasty. It was the first warm bed she'd had in months. But she said,
"I don't want your pity." "This is not pity. Maeve decided not to tell me what happened to you. You have to know that I wasn't aware you had..."
She slid an arm across the bed to grasp his hand. She knew that if she wanted to, she could strike him a wound so deep it would fracture him.
"I knew. At first, I was afraid you'd mock me if I told you, and I would kill you for it. Then I didn't want you to pity me. And more than any of that, I didn't want you to think it was ever an excuse."
"Like a good soldier,"
he said.
She had to look away for a moment to keep from letting him see just what that meant to her. He took a long breath that made his broad chest expand.
"Tell me how you were sent there, and how you got out."
She was tired in her bones, but she rallied her energy one last time and told him of the years in Rifthold, of stealing Asterian horses and racing across the desert, of dancing until dawn with courtesans and thieves and all the beautiful, wicked creatures in the world. And then she told him about losing Sam, and of that first whipping in Endovir when she'd spat blood in the chief overseer's face, and what she had seen and endured in the following year. She spoke of the day she had snapped and sprinted for her own death. Her heart grew heavy. When at last she got to the evening when the captain of the Royal Guard prowled into her life, and a tyrant's son had offered her a shot at freedom. She told him what she could about the competition, and how she'd won it, until her words slurred, and her eyelids drooped. There would be more time to tell him of what happened next, of the word keys and Elena and Nehemia, and how she had become so broken and useless. She yawned, and Rowan rubbed his eyes, his other hand still in hers. But he didn't let go. And when she awoke before dawn, warm and safe and rested, Rowan was still holding her hand, clasped to his chest. Something molten rushed through her, pouring over every crack and fracture still left gaping and open. Not to hurt or mar, but to weld, to forge. Chapter 43. Rowan didn't let her get out of bed that day. He brought trays of food, going so far as to make sure she consumed every last drop of beef stew, half a loaf of crusty bread, a bowl of the first spring berries, and a mug of ginger tea. He hardly needed to offer any encouragement to eat. She was starving. But if she didn't know better, she'd say he was fussing. Emerson Luca visited once to see if she was alive, took one look at Rowan's stone-cold face, heard the ripple of a growl, and took off, saying she was in more than competent hands and promising to come back when she was feeling better. "You know," Selena said, propped in bed with her fourth mug of tea for the day, "I highly doubt anyone is going to attack me now, if they've already put up with my nonsense for this long." Rowan, who was yet again poring over the map of the location of the bodies, didn't even look up from his seat at his work table. "This isn't negotiable." She might have laughed had her body not given a burst of twisting, blinding pain. She bore down on it, clenching her mug, focusing on her breathing. That was why she'd allowed him to fuss. Thanks to her magical meltdown last night, every damn part of her was sore. The constant throb and stinging and twisting, the headache between her brows, the fuzziness on the edge of her vision. Even sliding her gaze across the room sent sparks of pain through her head. "So you mean to tell me that whenever someone comes close to burnout, she not only goes through all of this misery, but if she's female, the males around her go this berserk?" He set down his pen and twisted to examine her. "This is hardly berserk. At least you can defend yourself by physical means when your magic is useless. For other fae, even if they've had weapons and defense training, if they can't touch their magic, they're vulnerable, especially when they're drained and in pain. That makes people, usually males, yes, somewhat edgy. Others have been known to kill without thought any perceived threat, real or otherwise."
"What sort of threat? Maeve's lands are peaceful."
She leaned over to set down her tea, but he was already moving, so swift that he intercepted her mug before it could hit the table. He took it from her with surprising gentleness, saw that she'd drained it, and poured another cup.
"Threats from anywhere. Males, females, creatures. You can't reason against it. Even if it wasn't in our culture, there would still be an instinct to protect the defenseless, regardless of whether they're female or male, young or old."
He reached for a slice of bread and a bowl of beef broth.
"Eat this."
"It pains me to say this, but one more bite and I'll be sick all over the place."
Oh, he was definitely fussing. And though it warmed her miserable heart, it was becoming rather irritating. The bastard just dipped the bread into the broth and held them out to her.
"You need to keep up your energy. You probably came so close to burnout because you didn't have enough food in your stomach.
Fine. It smelled too good to resist anyway. She took the bread and the broth. While she ate, he made sure the room passed inspection. The fire was still high, suffocatingly hot as it had been since morning, thanks to the chills that had racked her. Only one window was cracked, to allow in the slightest of breezes when she had hot flashes. The door was shut, and locked, and yet another pot of tea was waiting, currently steeping on his work table. When he was done ensuring all was accounted for and no threats lurked in the shadows, he looked her over with the same scrutiny. Skin, wan and gleaming from the remnants of those hot flashes. Lips, pale and cracked. Posture, limp and useless. Eyes, pain-dimmed and increasingly full of irritation. Rowan frowned again. After handing the empty bowl to him, she rubbed her thumb and forefinger against the persistent headache between her eyebrows. "So when the magic runs out," she said, "that's it? Either you stop or you burn out?" Rowan leaned back in his chair.
"Well, there's the Karanam."
The old language word was beautiful on his tongue, and if she'd had a death wish, she might have begged him to speak only in the ancient language, just to savor the exquisite sounds.
"It's hard to explain," Rowan went on. "I've only ever seen it used a handful of times on killing fields. When you're drained, your Karanam can yield their power to you, as long as you're compatible and actively sharing a blood connection."
She tilted her head to the side. "If we were Karanam, and I gave you my power, would you still only be using wind and ice, not my fire?" He nodded gravely. "How do you know if you're compatible with someone?"
"There's no way of telling until you try. And the bond is so rare that the majority of Fae never meet someone who is compatible, or whom they trust enough to test it out. There's always a threat that they could take too much, and if they're unskilled, they could shatter your mind. Or you could both burn out completely."
"Interesting. Could you ever just steal magic from someone?"
"Less savory Fae once attempted to do so, to win battles and add to their own power. But it never worked. And if it did, it was because the person they held hostage was coincidentally compatible. Maeve outlawed any forced bonds long before I was born. But I've been sent a few times to hunt down corrupt Fae who keep their Karanam as slaves. Usually the slaves are so broken there's no way to rehabilitate them. Putting them down is the only mercy I can offer."
His face and voice didn't change, but she said softly, "Doing that must be harder than all the wars and sieges you've ever waged." A shadow darted across his harsh face.
"Immortality is not as much of a gift as mortals would believe. It can breed monsters that even you would be sick to learn about. Imagine the sadists you've encountered, and then imagine them with millennia to hone their craft and warped desires."
Selena shuddered. "This conversation's become too awful to have after eating," she said, slumping against the pillows. "Tell me which one of your cadre is the handsomest, and if he would fancy me."
Rowan choked. "The thought of you with any of my companions makes my blood run cold."
"They're that awful? Your kitty cat friend looked decent enough."
Rowan's brows rose high. "I don't think my kitty cat friend would know what to do with you, nor would any of the others. It would likely end in bloodshed."
She kept grinning, and he crossed his arms.
"They would likely have very little interest in you, as you'll be old and decrepit soon enough, and thus not worth the effort it would take to win you."
She rolled her eyes.
"Killjoy."
Silence fell, and he looked her over again,
lucid if drained and moody. And she wasn't that surprised when he glanced at her bare wrists. One of the few bits of skin showing thanks to all the blankets he'd piled on top of her. They hadn't discussed it last night, but she knew he'd been working up to it. There was no judgment in his eyes as he said,
"A skilled healer could probably get rid of those scars. Definitely the ones on your wrist, and most on your back."
She clenched her jaw, but after a moment loosed a long breath. Even though she knew he would understand without much explanation, she said,
"There were cells in the bowels of the mines that they used to punish slaves. Cells so dark you would wake up in them and think you'd been blinded.
They locked me in there sometimes, once for 3 weeks straight. And the only thing that got me through it was reminding myself of my name, over and over and over. I am Selena Sardothian." Rowan's face was drawn, but she went on. "When they would let me out, so much of my mind had shut down in the darkness that the only thing I could remember was that my name was Selena. Selena Sardothian, arrogant and brave and skilled. Selena who did not know fear or despair. Selena who was a weapon honed by death." She ran a shaking hand through her hair. "I don't usually let myself think about that part of Endovir," she admitted. "After I got out, there were nights when I would wake up and think I was back in those cells, and I would have to light every candle in my room to prove I wasn't." "They don't just kill you in the mines. They break you. There are thousands of slaves in Endovir, and a good number are from Terrasen. Regardless of what I do with my birthright, I'm going to find a way to free them someday. I will free them. Them, and all the slaves in Calicula, too. So my scars serve as a reminder of that." She'd never said it, but there it was. Once she dealt with the King of Otterlin, if destroying him somehow didn't put an end to the labor camps, she would. Stone by stone, if necessary. Rowan asked,
"What happened 10 years ago, Aelin?"
"I'm not going to talk about that."
"If you took up your crown, you could free Endovir far more easily than—"
"I can't talk about it."
"Why?"
There was a pit in the memory. A pit she couldn't climb out of if she ever fell in. It wasn't her parents' deaths. She had been able to tell others in vague terms about their murders. That pain was still staggering, still haunted her. But waking up between their corpses wasn't the moment that had shattered everything Aelin Galathinius was and might have been. In the back of her mind, she heard another woman's voice, lovely and frantic. Another woman who... She rubbed her brows again.
"There is this rage," she said hoarsely.
"This despair and hatred and rage that lives and breathes inside me. There is no sanity to it, no gentleness. It is a monster dwelling under my skin. For the past 10 years, I have worked every day, every hour to keep that monster locked up. And the moment I talk about those 2 days, and what happened before and after, that monster is going to break loose and there will be no accounting for what I do. That is how I was able to stand before the King of Otterlin, how I was able to befriend his son and his captain, how I was able to live in that palace. Because I did not give that rage, those memories, 1 inch. And right now I am looking for the tools that might destroy my enemy, and I cannot let out the monster, because it will make me use those tools against the king, not put them back as I should. And I might very well destroy the world for spite. So that is why I must be Selena, not Aelin. Because being Aelin means facing those things and unleashing that monster. Do you understand?
for whatever it's worth. I don't think he would destroy the world from spite.
His voice turned hard.
But I also think you like to suffer. You collect scars because you want proof that you are paying for whatever sins you've committed. And I know this because I've been doing the same damn thing for 200 years. Tell me, do you think you will go to some blessed afterworld, or do you expect a burning hell? You're hoping for hell, because how could you face them in the afterworld? Better to suffer, to be damned for eternity, and—
That's enough,
she whispered. She must have sounded as miserable and small as she felt, because he turned back to the work table. She shut her eyes, but her heart was thundering. She didn't know how much time passed. After a while, the mattress shifted and groaned, and a warm body pressed against hers. Not holding her, just lying beside her. She didn't open her eyes, but she breathed in the smell of him, the pine and snow, and her pain settled a bit.
At least if you're going to hell,
he said, the vibrations in his chest rumbling against her.
Then we'll be there together.
I feel bad for the dark god already. He brushed a large hand down her hair, and she almost purred.
She hadn't realized just how much she missed being touched by anyone, friend or lover.
When I'm back to normal, can I assume you're going to yell at me about almost burning out?
He let out a soft laugh, but continued stroking her hair.
You have no idea.
She smiled against the pillow, and his hand stilled for a moment, then started again. After a long while, he murmured,
I have no doubt that you'll be able to free the slaves from the labor camp someday. No matter what name you use.
Her eyes burned behind their lids, but she leaned into his touch some more, even going so far as to put a hand on his broad chest, savoring the steady, assured heartbeat pounding beneath.
Thank you for looking after me,
she said. He grunted. Acceptance or dismissal, she didn't know. Sleep tugged at her, and she followed it into oblivion. Rowan kept her cooped up in his room for a few more days, and even once she told him she was feeling fine, he made her spend an extra half day in bed. She supposed it was nice having someone, even an overbearing, snarling fey warrior, bothering to care whether she lived or died. Her birthday arrived. 19 somehow felt rather dull, and her sole present was that Rowan left her alone for a few hours. He came back with the news of another demi-fey corpse found near the coast. She asked him to let her see it, but he flat out refused, barked at her was more like it, and said he'd already gone to see it himself. It was the same pattern. A dried nosebleed, a body drained until only a husk remained, and then a careless dumping. He'd also gone back to that town, where they had been more than happy to see him, since he'd brought gold and silver. And he'd returned to Selena with chocolates, since he claimed to be insulted that she considered his absence a proper birthday present. She tried to embrace him, but he would have none of that, and told her as much. Still, the next time she used the bathing room, she'd snuck behind his chair at the work table and planted a great smacking kiss on his cheek. He'd waved her off and wiped his face with a snarl, but she had the suspicion that he'd let her get past his defenses. It was a mistake to think that finally going back outdoors would be delightful. Selena was standing across a mossy clearing from Rowan, her knees slightly bent, hands in loose fists. Rowan hadn't told her to, but she'd gotten into a defensive position upon seeing the faint gleam in his eyes.
Rowan only looked like this when he was about to make her life a living hell. And since they hadn't gone to the temple ruins, she assumed he thought she'd at least mastered one element of her power, despite the events of Beltane. Which meant they were on to mastering the next.
"Your magic lacks shape," Rowan said at last,
standing so still that she envied him for it.
"And because it has no shape, you have little control. As a form of attack, a fireball or wave of flame is useful, yes. But if you are engaging a skilled combatant, if you want to be able to use your power, then you have to learn to fight with it."
She groaned.
"But,"
he added sharply,
"you have one advantage that many magic wielders do not. You already know how to fight with weapons."
First chocolates on my birthday, now an actual compliment. His eyes narrowed, and they had yet another of their wordless conversations.
"The more you talk, the more I'm going to make you pay in a moment."
She smiled slightly. "Apologies, Master. I am yours to instruct."
"Brat."
He jerked his chin at her.
"Your fire can take whatever form you wish, the only limit being your imagination. And considering your upbringing, should you go on the offensive..."
"You want me to make a sword out of fire?"
"Arrows, daggers, you direct the power. Visualize it, and use it as you would a mortal weapon."
She swallowed. He smirked.
"Afraid to play with fire, princess?"
"You won't be happy if I singe your eyebrows off."
"Try me." "When you trained as an assassin, what was the first thing you learned?"
"How to defend myself." She understood why he'd looked so amused for the past few minutes, when he said,
"Good."
Not surprisingly, having ice daggers thrown at her was miserable. Rowan hurled dagger after magical dagger at her. And every damn time the shield of fire that she tried, and failed to imagine, did nothing. If it appeared at all, it always manifested too far to the left or right. Rowan didn't want a wall of flame. No, he wanted a small, controlled shield, and it didn't matter how many times he nicked her hands or arms or face. It didn't matter that dried blood was now itching down her cheeks. One shield. That was all she had to craft, and he would stop. Sweating and panting, Selena was beginning to wonder if she should step directly into the path of his next dagger and put herself out of her suffering, when Rowan growled,
"Try harder."
"I am trying," she snapped, rolling aside as he sent two gleaming ice daggers at her head.
"You're acting like you're on the verge of a burnout."
"Maybe I am."
"If you believe for one moment that you're close to a burnout after an hour of practicing..."
"It happened that quickly on Beltane."
"That was not the end of your power."
His next ice dagger hovered in the air beside his head.
"You fell into the lure of the magic and let it do what it wanted. Let it consume you. Had you kept your head, you could have had those fires burning for weeks, months."
"No." She didn't have any better answer than that. His nostrils flared slightly.
"I knew it. You wanted your power to be insignificant. You were relieved when you thought that was all you had."
Without warning, he sent the dagger, then the next at her. She raised her left arm as she would raise a shield, picturing the flame surrounding her arm, blocking those daggers, obliterating them. But she cursed so loudly that the birds stopped their chatter. She clutched her forearm as blood welled and soaked into her tunic. "Stop hitting me! I get the point!" But another dagger came, and another. Ducking and dodging, raising her bloodied arm again and again, she gritted her teeth and swore at him. He sent a dagger twirling with deadly efficiency,
and she couldn't move fast enough to avoid the thin scratch along her cheekbone. She hissed. He was right. He was always right, and she hated that. Almost as much as she hated the power that flooded her and did what it wanted. It was hers to command, not the other way around. She was not its slave. She was no one's slave anymore. And if Rowan threw one more damned dagger at her face... He did. The ice crystal didn't make it past her upraised forearm before it vanished in a hiss of steam. Selena gazed over the flickering edge of the compact red-burning flame before her arm. Shaped like... a shield. Rowan smiled slowly.
We're done for today. Go eat something.
The circular shield did not burn her, though its flames swirled and sizzled. As she'd commanded, it had worked. So she raised her eyes to Rowan. No. Again. After a week of making shields of various sizes and temperatures, Selena could have multiple defenses burning at once and encircle the entire glen with half a thought to protect it from outside assault. And when she awoke one morning before dawn, she couldn't say why she did it, but she slipped from the room she shared with Rowan and went down to the ward stones. She shivered from more than the early morning cold as the power of the curving gate stones zinged against her skin when she passed through. But none of the sentries on the battlements ordered her to stop as she walked along the line of towering carved rocks until she found a bit of even ground and began to practice. Chapter 44. As one, the 13 flew. As one, the 13 led the other Blackbeak covens in the skies. Drill after drill, through rain and sun and wind, until they were all tanned and freckled. Even though Abraxos had yet to make the crossing, the spider silk patching on his wings improved his flying significantly. It was all going beautifully. Abraxos had gotten into a brawl for dominance with Lynn's bull, and emerged victorious, and after that, none in her coven or any other challenged him. The war games were fast approaching, and though Iskra hadn't been in any trouble since the night Manon had half-killed her, they watched their backs, in the baths, around every dark corner, double-checking every rein and strap before they mounted their wyverns. Yes, it was all going beautifully, until Manon was summoned to her grandmother's room.
"Why is it?"
her grandmother said by way of greeting, pacing the room, teeth always out.
"That I have to hear from God's damned Cressida that your runty, useless wyvern hasn't made the crossing. Why is it that I am in the middle of a meeting, planning these war games so you can win? And the other matrons tell me that you aren't allowed to participate because your mount will not make the crossing and therefore isn't allowed to fly in the host."
Manon glimpsed the flash of nails before they raked down her cheek. Not hard enough to scar, but enough to bleed.
"You and that beast are an embarrassment," her grandmother hissed, teeth snapping in her face. "All I want is for you to win these games, so we can take our rightful place as queens, not high witches. Queens of the Waste, Manon. And you are doing your best to ruin it."
Manon kept her eyes on the ground. Her grandmother dug a nail into her chest, cutting through her red cloak, piercing the flesh right above her heart.
"Has your heart melted?"
"No."
"No," her grandmother sneered. "No, it cannot melt, because you do not have a heart, Manon. We are not born with them, and we are glad of it."
She pointed to the stone floor.
"Why is it that I am informed today that Iskra caught a god's damned Kraken spying on us? Why am I the last to know that she is in our dungeons, and that they have been interrogating her for 2 days?
Manon blinked, but that was all the surprise she let show. If Crokins were spying on them.
Another slice to the face, marring the other cheek.
You will make the crossing tomorrow, Manon. Tomorrow. And I don't care if you splatter yourself on the rocks. If you live, you had better pray to the darkness that you win those games. Because if you don't...
Her grandmother sliced a nail across Manon's throat. A scratch to set the blood running. And a promise. Everyone came this time to watch the crossing. Abraxos was saddled, focus pinned on the cave mouth open to the night beyond. Asterin and Sorrel were behind her, but beside their mounts, not astride them. Her grandmother had gotten wind of how they planned to save her and forbidden it. It was Manon's own stupidity and pride that had to pay, she'd said. Witches lined the viewing platform, and from high above, the high witches and their heirs watched from a small balcony. The noise was near deafening. Manon glanced at Asterin and Sorrel and found them looking stone-cold, fierce, but tense.
"Keep to the walls so he doesn't spook your wyverns," she told them.
They nodded grimly. Since grafting the spider silk onto Abraxos' wings, Manon had been careful not to push him too hard until the healing was absolutely complete. But the crossing, with its plunge and winds... His wings could be shredded in a matter of seconds if the silk didn't hold.
"We're waiting, Manon," her grandmother barked from above. She waved a hand toward the cave mouth. "But by all means, take your time."
Laughter. From the yellow legs, black beaks. Everyone. Yet Petra wasn't smiling. And none of the 13, gathered closest along the viewing platform, were smiling either. Manon turned to Abraxos, looking into those eyes.
"Let's go."
She tugged on the reins. But he refused to move, not from fear or terror. He slowly lifted his head, looking to where her grandmother stood, and let out a low warning growl. A threat. Manon knew she should reprimand him for the disrespect, but the fact that he could grasp what was occurring in this hall, it should have been impossible.
"The night is waning," her grandmother called, heedless of the beast that stared at her with such rage in his eyes.
Sorrel and Asterin exchanged glances, and she could have sworn her second's hand twitched toward the hilt of her sword. Not to hurt Abraxos, but... Every single one of the 13 was casually reaching for their weapons, to fight their way out, in case her grandmother gave the order to have Manon and Abraxos put down. They'd heard the challenge in Abraxos's growl, understood that the beast had drawn a line in the sand. They were not born with hearts, her grandmother said. They had all been told that. Obedience, discipline, brutality. Those were the things they were supposed to cherish. Asterin's eyes were bright, stunningly bright, and she nodded once at Manon. It was that same feeling she'd gotten when Iskra whipped Abraxos. That thing she couldn't describe, but it blinded her. Manon gripped Abraxos's snout, forcing his gaze away from her grandmother.
"Just once," she whispered. "All you have to do is make this jump just once, Abraxos, and then you can shut them up forever."
Then, rising up from the deep, there came a steady two-note beat. The beat of the chained bait beasts who hauled the massive machines around, like a thudding heart, or beating wings. Louder the beat sounded, as if the wyverns down in the pits knew what was happening.
It grew and grew, until it reached the cavern, until Asterin reached for her shield and joined in, until each one of the 13 took up the beat.
You hear that? That is for you.
For a moment, as the beat pulsed around them, phantom wings from the mountain itself, Manon thought that it would not be so bad to die. If it was with him, if she was not alone.
You are one of the 13, she said to him, from now until the darkness cleaves us apart. You are mine, and I am yours. Let's show them why.
He huffed into her palms as if to say he already knew all of that, and that she was just wasting time. She smiled faintly, even as Abraxos cast another challenging glare in her grandmother's direction. The Wyvern lowered himself to the ground for Manon to climb into the saddle. The distance to the entrance seemed so much shorter in the saddle than on foot. But she did not let herself doubt him as she blinked her inner lid into place and retracted her teeth. The spider silk would hold. She would consider no other alternative.
Fly, Abraxos,
she told him, and dug her spurs into his sides. Like a roaring star, he thundered down the long chute, and Manon moved with him, meeting each gallop of his powerful body, each step in time with the beat of the wyverns locked in the belly of the mountain. Abraxos flapped his wings open, pounding them once, twice, gathering speed, fearless, unrelenting, ready. Still, the beat did not stop, not from the wyverns or from the 13 or from the Blackbeak Covens, who picked it up, stomping their feet or clapping their hands. Not from the Blueblood Heir, who clapped her sword against her dagger, or the Blueblood Witches who followed her lead. The entire mountain shook with the sound. Faster and faster, Abraxos raced for the drop, and Manon held on tight. The cave mouth opened wide. Abraxos tucked in his wings, using the movement to give his body one last shove over the lip as he took Manon with him, and plunged. Fast as lightning arcing across the sky, he plummeted toward the gap floor. Manon rose up into the saddle, clinging as her braid ripped free from her cloak, then came loose from its bonds, pulling painfully behind her, making her eyes water despite the lids. Down and down he fell, wings tucked in tight, tail straight and balanced. Down into hell, into eternity, into that world where, for a moment, she could have sworn that something tightened in her chest. She did not shut her eyes, not as the moon-illuminated stones of the gap became closer, clearer. She did not need to. Like the sails of a mighty ship, Abraxos's wings unfurled, snapping tight. He tilted them upward, pulling against the death trying to drag them down. And it was those wings, covered in glimmering patches of spider silk, that stayed strong and sturdy, sending them soaring clean up the side of the Omega and into the starry sky beyond. Chapter 45. To their credit, the sentries didn't jump when Rowan shifted beside them atop the battlement wall. They had eyes keen enough to have detected his arrival as he swooped in. A slight tang of fear leaked from them, but that was to be expected, even if it troubled him more than it had in the past. But they did stir slightly when he spoke.
How long has she been down there?
An hour, Prince, one said, watching the flashing flames below.
For how many mornings in a row?
This is the fourth, Prince,
the same sentry replied. The first 3 days she'd slipped from bed before dawn, he'd assumed she'd been helping in the kitchens. But when they'd trained yesterday, she'd improved at a rate she shouldn't have, as if overnight. He had to give her credit for resourcefulness. The girl stood outside the ward stones, fighting with herself. A dagger of flame flew from her hand toward the invisible barrier between two stones, then another,